thank you for joining us for the Dialogue Out Loud podcast. My name is Teresa Wellborn, Dialogue's poetry editor. Founded in 1966, Dialogue is the oldest independent journal of Mormonism, publishing scholarship, art, and poetry, as well as fiction on the Latter-day Saint experience. Today, we are in conversation with Doug Barrett, one of the poets featured in our summer 2025 issue. Doug, happy to have you here tonight.
Glad to be here.
So just a brief bio we'd like to share before we begin. Doug Barrett has served in the Japan West Mission. He holds a PhD in English literature from the University of Washington and has taught at Sierra Nevada College, Deep Springs College, and Western Nevada College. He has also been a camp counselor, a wrangler, a bank courier, retail clerk, postal worker, census worker, and academic labor organizer. His poetry has appeared in various publications, including The Canary, Weber, The Contemporary West, Abocet, and elsewhere. And he currently resides in Maine. Doug, it looks like we have three of your poems that we published in our summer 2025 issue. The first is Crossing Over, the second, A Little Death, and the third, Momiji. Did I pronounce that correctly?
Momiji.
Momiji? Okay, wonderful. Okay. Each one of those had a resonance for me personally that really struck me as meaningful, and they were poems that I don't know if you can see, but I did a lot of marking up, highlighting, much like an undergrad would, right? So many notes here. I found them layers of meaning in them. So the pairing that struck me was A Little Death as well as Momiji, as those speak to your Japanese, your mission in Japan. And then the other one, Crossing Over, did take me a bit of time to kind of unravel, as one does with a poem, right? So that one I felt spoke to a crisis of faith, or perhaps a shift in belief or in life. And I did note that it is for Dan, Washington, D.C. North Mission, 1998 to 2000. So I did feel as if perhaps it was a voice of a wise or experienced individual speaking to possibly a younger individual. But sometimes that's a guess. And you know what? It's fun to have the conversation here about that. So, okay. So let's see. Would you like to share an excerpt to start? One of the excerpts from one of these poems?
Right. Why don't I read the first couple of stanzas of Momiji?
Okay.
Momiji for RHM. Recall in your mind's eye this sight, two white-shirted figures exploring the October hills above Nagasaki, enjoying the freedom to talk unencumbered. Sometimes you said, I think nature has a way of playing Bach to itself. Ascending a path through terraced fields in the serene late morning light, at forest edge they found a great stone staircase winding up into the trees, then a gate in a stucco wall. Within was the flagstone courtyard, immaculately swept, of a Shinto shrine, the windowless cordovan buildings sleepy with the peace of the place. The entire sanctuary canopied in fiery momiji. Here a wooden dipper upon a well. A priest appeared and seemed to motion them to drink. The water was ice cold. How long since the sun had shone here, beneath this flaming red roof, this maple sea? They stood speechless under the silence of flickering crimson as breezes danced the upper leaves, barely daring to move, the place performing the work of attunement, decades, centuries of daily sweeping and contemplation, as if the gift they'd sought so hard to give had found them at last.
You know, that phrasing that you have, the work of attunement, it feels so fresh and unique to me, and yet also so indicative of what missionary work is and what perhaps they're experiencing. And then to me, there's allusions of the work of the atonement, possibly.
Yes, and of course, it's designed to suggest that.
Mm-hmm.
The work of attunement. Attunement to what? And it's the last the line after that, of course, I think that gives away what this poem is really about. And what all three of these dialogue poems are about, and that's the aestheticizing of the mission experience. Mm-hmm. And that's perhaps a disquieting approach for some people. Is this really what the mission experience is supposed to be about? What happened to, we'll go to the poor like our captain of old and seek out the weary and hungry and cold and so forth. It's something different from that I'm working with in these poems. Can you justify this revisioning of the mission experience? I've been reading, rereading a critic, Ivor Winters, lately, and he has this take on poetry where he says, basically, poetry is the creation of experience or conveying of an experience plus a moral judgment or a rational judgment on it. Mm-hmm. And with that, if you accept that, then you accept that readers, too, are now called upon to judge the poet's judgment. Mm-hmm. And is this poetry, is it sentimental? Is it trivial? Is it nihilistic, cynical, dishonest in some way? We all have to make that judgment when we read. Mm. I'm called upon, and I expect to be asked to, or implicitly to justify what I was doing. And I do it this way. And I'd say, Nietzsche says, only aesthetically is existence and the world justified. So once you've brought in the hungry and helpless and cold and healed everybody spiritually and temporally, then what? And Dante in the Paradiso, I think, winds up in this same place. And Keats, when he says beauty is truth, truth beauty, is probably trying for the same kind of thought. We get a hint of this, I think, in DNC 88, 45 through 50. You get a sense of this very poetic immanence, divinity in all things, and that's apprehended aesthetically. Mm-hmm. This can come and strike you at seemingly inopportune times, but that's what generates poetry, as opposed to, say, morality or rationality.
Absolutely, yeah. In past dialogue podcasts with prior poets we published with dialogue, I've had a conversation with many about the intersection of temporal, or, you know, earthiness, and then this ethereal, otherworldly kind of immanence that exists, you know, this being, Heavenly Mother, Heavenly Father, Allah, you know, whoever that being might be, nature, you know. And I feel, in reading your poems, questing, I feel wonder, I feel rich cultural appreciation. I also have a sense of curiosity. Having walked steps in my own mission, mine was in South America, but I appreciate the thoughts that all the worker bees are doing so much work, or the worker ants, right? Doing the day-to-dayness, which is good. And how can we, in that day-to-dayness, right? And then reflecting years, and for me, and likely yourself, decades later, how can we pull out strands of beauty or wonder in that day-to-dayness that we might have experienced as a missionary? And I got that sense when I read this. I thought, I need to meet Doug. We've got to have a talk about these beautiful poems. So thank you. So I do have a question or two for you as well. If we could turn to that. How has your vast and varied work experience informed your path and vision as a poet? And I would like to briefly just mention the Deep Springs College experience. It is such a fascinating institution. And I don't know if our readers know much about that. If you have a minute to give us a thumbnail view of that institution, since I believe it was at 1917 that it was established. So
17, yeah.
Yeah. And it was established as a, yeah, please.
Springs College was founded by a Western power magnate named L.L. Nunn, who lived in Provo for a while and even has a park named after him up Provo Canyon.
Oh.
Go up there and check it out.
I will.
Yeah. It was founded as a men's only college. It's now become co-ed. When I was there, it was still male only. Nunn's philosophy was he wanted people working for him who had practical knowledge as well as theoretical knowledge. And so the college was, and I believe still is, structured so that in the morning you have your classes, in the afternoon you do ranch labor. And students do everything from irrigation to machinery, cooking, dairy. They have a cowboy who rides herd on the cattle.
Fascinating.
Yeah. Various, everybody has a job to do.
Including faculty? Did faculty as well?
No. The faculty are just faculty.
Gotcha, gotcha. Okay, gotcha. Wasn't sure if you guys rolled up your sleeves as well. And
well, you know, faculty are given opportunity to do some things, you know, like help in the kitchen, stuff like that.
Okay. Wow. Unorthodox, for sure. You know, and the student body is quite small. I believe it is in the 20s or 30s, right? Students?
It's under 25, I believe.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. And it's an isolated community. It's located in the Deep Springs Valley, which lies between the, it lies east of the White Mountains. So you cross the, you have the Sierras, then you have like the Owens Valley, then the White Mountains. Cross that, you get into Deep Springs Valley.
Okay.
About 45 minutes, 45 miles or a little more from any of the nearest towns. And Nunn made it that way deliberately. He did not want anything but a enclosed community where you work together, live together, thought together, talked together. The year I was there was a pretty contentious year, and I understand it wasn't usually that way.
Oh.
But, you know, you have a closed community, take what you get.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
But it was a memorable year. I have actually been working on a poem about that year. It's a kind of a long one. You started out by asking about my work experience in poetry and all that. How has it affected my poetry? The short answer is that it hasn't really a whole lot. You know, you mentioned Gary Snyder when we were talking before. He has done a lot of things that I wish I could have done. You know, he tells about how he spent months on a tanker at sea working, and no one ever guessed that he had been to college, according to him. I'm not like that. I grew up in a middle-class suburban household that, hardly knew any practical skills, tried to acquire some at various times. I have one poem called Hard Time Car Trouble Blues about my incompetence in keeping the VW van running, which contains the line, I curse Gary Snyder from here to Mars for making like poets can work on cars.
Nice. I'll have to check that one out.
It hasn't been published yet, but.
Oh, it's not published. Okay, well, let me know when it's published.
The one area that has bled over into poetry is education. There's that Deep Springs poem. I have another one about a philosophy class I taught at Sierra Nevada College. I'm still working on that one. And a couple of others, even been just watching birds teach their young adult, something I'm interested in.
Interesting. So are you a birder? Is that the term? Okay. And I do believe there is some birding mentioned in Crossing Over. Do you have a minute to talk about that one?
Okay. That is about a trip that my son Dan and I took to Point Reyes National Seashore shortly before he left on his mission. And that's kind of a holy place, one of the most beautiful places on earth.
Oh, wow.
We had a good experience there that I tried to put in. And
I loved your frankness. You used the phrase, the kind of birding you hate. And I really appreciate that because I see a little bit of, wry, some humor bubbling up there. I like the refrain that you used, who can say it's over? I did feel like that was a repetitive note in that poem. And then the end felt very solid. The light, and it isn't over. And I felt like that I believe that was the fourth refrain phrased slightly differently. And I did feel like that note didn't end as a low note or negative, but ended as a question mark. It isn't over. Whether that means I interpreted it as possibly faith or friendship or maybe the dissolution of a family, but it could be applicable, right? As poetry is to many things in many readers' lives. So I really appreciated that. There also the phrasing. Your phrasing's amazing. I'm just a fangirl, so please be patient. But I'm just going to read just a bit here. Scent mosaic. I felt that was a thrilling pairing. That phrasing, scent mosaic. Poison oak, backlit as if from within, rent it still scuffling, immersed in hidden bird paths, silky soft air. Could you believe it's always been like this? It's just beautiful. I felt that was ethereal, a bit melancholy, wondrous, and just spot on. So, that poem is a lovely one. I felt some wistfulness in that. And I did guess it was a conversation to a son. That was my guess on that one. Okay, is it okay if we move forward to the next question? Second of the two. So how do you envision or re-envision faith and LDS mission experience with the passage of time after gaining life wisdom and insight?
My mission experience was positive in a great many ways. I was able to help baptize several good people, met a couple of lifelong friends, got grounded in the gospel, learned the scriptures much better than I ever would have otherwise, got immersed in a culture that's stayed with me and my family ever since. I had an excellent mission president, Kon Watanabe, who was not big on rules, but just wanted us to be fully committed.
Nice. Yeah, let them go up themselves. That's my kind of leader as well. Not getting in the the details and minutiae, but, you know, having that faith and trust, and especially young people, the older I get, I'm like, you know, that concept is maybe revolutionary to some, but I'm happy and grateful that you had that.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, though, I interrupted you.
Okay. So all those were the pluses. The downside was that I managed to absorb a kind of transactional spirituality through it all. The idea that if you do all this for God, then he's going to do something for you.
Mm-hmm.
Give you blessings and so forth. And there were blessings I wanted. I wanted my dad to be active in the church, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And so I bought into this transactional spirituality, which is actually refers everything to the superego.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
The internal voice of social authority.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And this internal voice of social authority is always accusing you of everything that you do that's not perfect, everything that's not doing everything that everybody wants you to do.
Mm-hmm.
And as you learn in Revelation 12:10, that accusing voice is the devil.
Mm-hmm.
He's the accuser.
Mm-hmm.
And Jesus, as our advocate, is defending the accused in the courtroom of the mind, so to speak.
Right.
What you have to do is to get free of that superego conditioning. Interestingly, one of the things that helped me do that the most was studying Zen Buddhism.
Oh, mm-hmm.
Which is a really good antidote to transactional spirituality. In fact, it laughs at those kinds mm-hmm. of things.
Yep. Pema Chodron is one of my favorite Buddhist authors. So I don't know if I'm saying her name correctly. Pema?
I'm not sure myself. Yeah, okay.
I've read a few of hers as I've dabbled a little bit in Buddhism, and deeply appreciate being in the moment and the teachings that I've drawn in my brief time studying it. I really appreciate this conversation. I feel the depth here is considerable. also based on, of course, your experiences and the thought that you've put into being a human and your experiences and writing and all of that. The little death, or a little death, that poem, I felt, you know, reminiscent at times. The poem was of Miyazaki. Are you familiar with him?
Yes.
Okay. And I don't mean to make light of your writing, but I really sensed Miyazaki, the Japanese animator and a filmmaker, kind of exuding a little bit here and there.
That is very interesting. I love Miyazaki's stuff. Spirit of Way, Princess Mononoke, and Lolita, and Nausicaa, and
Hi, My Neighbor Totoro.
Those are my four standard works of film, anime, or at least.
Mm-hmm. Lovely. That's lovely. I wanted to mention earlier, but yeah, I also felt that your Momiji and The Little Death both, I wrote Miyazaki-esque in the corner.
And I've never thought of anything I've done as in terms of Miyazaki. So this is kind of an interesting perspective for me on my own work. I would not have.
Yeah, just some little notes here and there. I felt so it might have been more in Momiji that there's a path, isn't there? There the gate is mentioned. A dipper upon a well. Some of those images in my mind really spoke to. The small red Tory stood, and there on top they ate lunch, but took no pictures except in the mind. And how beautiful is that? So I appreciate, I felt there was an interplay here. Let me look at my notes. Oh, just between you know, the Mormon missionaries. So, and you had spoken about, you know, how some folks might, you particularly mentioned a transactional, how you that might be a takeaway from a mission experience or any type of, you said initiation, you know, in our society or in the world. So the interplay there, though, between like rule following and then also an adherence, then maybe listening to that superego, if I'm getting what you're saying correctly, right? The courtroom of the mind where you feel like you're needing to do conscripted to different rules. But then also that weightlessness and that companionless, those moments where, and you capture it so well. But would you like to read that bit or?
And maybe a little background on this. This is about getting out of the hospital in Nagasaki after spending a week or so there with pneumonia, finding that all the rest of the missionaries in the mission had taken off to Fukuoka for a conference. And so I'm completely on my own, which is a very different experience than what you usually get in the mission field. Weightless, companionless, no mouth to my ear, no loyal, soul-absorbing voice, but rather every unkept pore seemed to breathe for the first time in Japan, seemed to draw in the spirit of that garbled, unmanageable world of people heading to places they never knew they'd never get to. A world of silent traffic, shops and houses, wonderful, ordinary, and strange, and to breathe me out into that world so that I seemed to be not in Japan, but inside Japan. Rules, too, had dissolved. Why, I could have. But the thought never really occurred, only the quiet wish to have this walk last as long as possible, and indeed, it hasn't ended yet.
Beautiful. I also appreciate, I'm just going to read that next sentence after that. Which train did I take to... How do you pronounce that? Fukuoka?
Fukuoka.
I'm going to skip that, but thank you. That. The slow train or the express. And I like that you do not answer that, but I think you took the slow train. And I hope you did. As, you know, you know, to savor that aloneness, that really out of, I don't want to say out of body, but it's really an odd, there was just a moment in my own mission after I was with my trainer 6 months and she was a Utah girl. I was a Nevada girl. And after, you know, we had that transition day and I was alone for several hours and I walked out of our apartment alone, walked down to a payphone, called mom. I was an older missionary. I'd already graduated my undergrad. And I'm like, I'm going to break rules and do it my way. So I guess the secret's out. But what I want to say is that out those few hours I had alone, you know, I had similar thoughts. And so I just deeply appreciate why I could have and the thoughts that one might experience as a missionary having those few untethered hours. Okay, so in closing, I'd like to share a quote by Heraclitus. And in reading this poem, or pardon me, this quote, I just felt as if it really related deeply with your poems, Doug. Everything flows into everything and carries with it and within it all lives of its life and others' life. And all is murmuring and whispering of things changing into each other, breeding and searching and reaching and withdrawing and dying. In close, Doug, is there any last thought you'd like to share?
I actually scribbled up quite a few notes preparatory to this interview, a lot of which we've covered. But... I'll tell just a little bit here about how I came to English literature. I didn't take an English class until I was done with my mission. I'd done 2.5 years of college. I didn't take a single English class until then. I took
philosophy, psychology, anthropology, sociology, even mathematics a little bit. But then when I got to BYU, I dove into English. And, and I'd gone back and forth between a zillion majors. I finally realized, okay, in English, I can draw on anything. I can go in any direction. And squeeze it all into a ball, so to speak. And that seems to me where it's at. Joseph and Brigham talked about how all truth is comprehended in the gospel. And there's nothing, I think, that gives you a better chance, a better opportunity to gather all truth in one than in literature. And poetry, the most condensed of all, of these ways of doing it. Going down the quotation rabbit hole a little further, Norman Mailer, I believe, quotes Thomas Mann saying that only the exhaustive is truly interesting. So what is there for an LDS intellectual to do ultimately, but to try to squeeze the universe into a ball, rolling toward overwhelming questions, not with that kind of sad proof rock dung beetle irony, but in the spirit of good fun, because what can really be more fun than that?
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, that's 100% agree. Thank you, Doug. As you said, taking all of life experience and rolling it up and creating poetry for, oneself and others it's a joy. And I find it a privilege as well. And so privileged tonight to have this conversation with you. I appreciate this.
I enjoyed it so much. Thank you, Teresa.
Thank you. Okay, by way of closing tonight, thank you for listening. Please share this podcast with a friend. Check out the entire lineup of excellent podcasts in the Dialogue Podcast Network by visiting dialoguejournal.com. And check out the other podcasts that include Relationscapes, Latter-day Struggles with Valerie Haymaker, Beyond the Block with Brothers Jones and Knox, Face in a Hat, and more. Dialogue Out Loud is produced and edited by Daniel Foster Smith, and our executive producers are Emily Jensen, Carolyn Klein, and Margaret Olson Hemming. Thank you.
Greetings. My name is Rebecca DeSchweinitz, and I'm thrilled to serve as a board member at the Dialogue Foundation and as one of the hosts of Dialogue Gospel Study. In each episode, which we record live the second and fourth Sunday of every month, we welcome esteemed speakers from a variety of backgrounds to share their insights and perspectives on the Come Follow Me lessons. Our aim is to spark meaningful conversations about the scriptures, to connect them to our personal experiences and to our understandings and explorations of the gospel. To stay in the loop with our upcoming lessons and this opportunity to engage with Mormon thought, culture, and belief, be sure to visit dialoguejournal.com and sign up for our newsletter. By doing so, you'll receive updates and timely links to join our live stream lessons. Additionally, you can catch up on our past guests and episodes by subscribing to Dialogue Journal on YouTube, Facebook, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Dialogue Podcast Network.